Shop the Sherwin-Williams Winter Sale and get 30% off paints and stains January 9th through the 19th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
We must go to the mayor.
Appeal to
him. No, not appeal. Tell him. Tell him what I am. Tell him I've confessed to everything.
What?
Tell him I've confessed. That you must have me executed now.
Welcome back, folks, to another episode of Hooked on Hammer, the podcast where we delve into the wonderful world of Hammer horror. I'm your host, Adam, and my co-host joining me as always, Mike.
Hello.
So today's film, we're going to be looking at The Curse of the Werewolf, the 1961 film from Terence Fisher.
The Curse of the Werewolf. That was laid on a baby who grew into a man possessed by a monster. To this Spanish town, the night brought drinking and dancing, music and girls, and the moon. The full moon that turned an innocent man into a savage beast.
But you've been looking forward to this one.
It is probably... I'd say this is probably one of my favourite werewolf films.
In general?
I'd say in general. It's up there with like The Howling, Dog Soldiers and American Werewolf for me.
Okay.
It's just so different.
Yeah. I mean, there are similarities with the other Wolfman-esque films.
The Wolfman films.
Yeah. But it just does something a little bleaker than all of those.
There's no happy moment in this, except for like maybe one or two scenes with some drunk people in, but that's about it.
I was happy before I watched the film.
You're at the bottom of a bottle by the time it finished. So, let's get started. Cue the footsteps.
Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
In the name of God, you dare not!
This is more than a superstition.
I know. The danger is very real.
It's a criminal lunatic. He tried to kill you.
We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead.
It begins. Come on.
So before we get into The Curse of Werewolf, I think we need to talk a bit about behind the scenes and what actually happened in the build-up to this film.
Yeah.
Because there's quite an interesting story behind how this film actually came to be.
Yeah.
Hammer were doing, they were prepping pre-production for two films, weren't they?
This one and Rape of Sabina.
Nice family film.
Yeah.
Lovely family. The title should sell that one alone. I think the other one they had, it was The Rape of Sabina or The Inquisitor, it was also called.
Yeah, or Inquisition or something.
Yeah, bit of a better title than The Rape. Yeah.
It's the alternative title.
So they were prepping for both of these to be made, going into pre-production. They submitted the script to the BBFC, and basically the BBFC turned around and was like, if you make this the way that it's scripted, it's going to be banned for exhibition in the UK.
Yeah.
So shit hit the fan, basically.
You've got to think of the time that it was. They went into pre-production in 1960.
Yeah.
And at that point, we have two major films in both America and Britain.
Yeah.
With Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho and Powell's Peeping Tom.
Yeah, they caused issues. Yeah. There were numerous issues.
Exactly. And new management within the BBFC, of course, we have a new conservative approach to how we review, how we classify, and how we censor.
Lord Herbert Morrison.
That is the guy.
He even sounds like a dick, doesn't he, let's be honest.
He's definitely had a peerage.
Well, he was foreign secretary, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I believe he was for the British Conservatives.
That's immediately, you know, he's trustworthy.
And of course, this is a few years before we have quite a lot of uproar with the National Viewers and Listening Association, and then on to Amy Winehouse's crusade with the Video Nasties,
yeah,
less than two decades after this point. So a lot of change needed to happen.
Yeah.
And at this point, Hammer was being made an example of.
Well, from what I understand from reading up on this, and the countless other bits I've done over the years, they didn't really want Hammer making horror films anymore, did they?
No, because they were pushing the boundaries. Every film they made from, let's say, Quartermass, and Quartermass and the Pit and things like that, from that point, they just kept going higher and higher and pushing that bar.
Well, yeah, we talked about it in some of our previous episodes. A perfect example would be, obviously, the head in Curse of Frankenstein being dissolved in acid. And we got really excited at the premiere, didn't we?
Yeah, we thought it was going
to
be there.
They found the lost footage. Me and Mike were lucky enough to be invited to the premiere of Hammer. Is it Heroes, Gods and Monsters, wasn't it? I'm sure it was Heroes, Gods and Monsters.
Is it Heroes, Gods and Monsters?
Either way, we were lucky enough to be invited to the premiere. Really enjoyed it. But yeah, when they were saying, oh, there's something you may not have seen before, they went under the Curse of Frankenstein, didn't they?
Yeah.
And we were both like, oh my god, they've actually found the footage.
Yeah. But very excited for
it. Sadly, it wasn't meant to be, unfortunately. I swear it'd be cool if, like, anyone, even if it was a really bad quality, like, even just to get hold of that footage would be incredible.
Well, it's how we got the eye close up. It was from the Japanese release. And I think it was the VHS ones, and then Studio Canal put it into the finished product.
Yeah.
So if, by some chance, with these new releases coming out, of course, we've got Captain Kronos, Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
Vampire Hunter.
Vampire
Slayer. Limited edition release.
Yeah, that looks really good, to be fair.
Lovely 4K restoration. With the, like, the advertising trailers and teasers that they have, they show the original.
Oh, I know, you can see the quality of it. It's incredible.
It's stunning. So I would hope that maybe looking through the archive, looking through past patent holders and purchases of the original reels, we may be able to find that shot.
Yeah, well, laying hope.
Just throwing her out there, Hammer. If you want Adam and I to make, like, a documentary of In Search for that shot, we will.
That'd be quite cool, actually. I'd be very much up for that. Or we can just, because it did, like, the documentary was quite cool and they went into, like, how they did it.
Yeah.
And, like, it was, like, layer upon layer, like, mortician's wax and, like, other. It was, like, more like household items, basically.
Well, again, like, the makeup that they put on.
Oh, yeah. Christopher Lee. On Christopher Lee and Curse of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I'd like to give it a go actually redoing it. That would be quite cool to actually build the head and redo it.
Yeah. Because they made it to disintegrate at slower paces.
Yeah, I know.
So that, of course, the skin will go first, then the muscle, and then the bone will gradually.
Kind of like the Nazi dude in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the melt.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you can buy a fucking candle and light it, and it just melts him away slowly. It's probably, like, one of the best things I've seen on the internet.
Well, you'd want a candle that does the face melting and not the head exploding.
I mean, I'd pay for a head exploding candle as well if I knew that was good. You could probably do, like, a normal candle, just replace the wick with a firecracker.
I was thinking a firecracker.
Just literally just stick at the top. But, sorry, we're going off topic. So the censorship, obviously, at the time was this new guy came in, he wanted to make a name for himself, shall we say.
Yeah, and follow the traditional conservative values.
Yeah.
Again, not the political conservative values, but traditional British values.
Well, obviously, this is years and years ago. You know, values have changed considerably since.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the class system and stuff is vastly different.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. So, with all this in mind, so in the end, it was James Carreras who actually said to the censor board, BBC, okay, fine, we'll strike this and the Rape of Sabina from the production schedule. We won't make them. End of story. So, you know, thinking all is good, but then in a weird turn of events, they'd already built the set for Rape of Sabina, which was set in Spain.
Because they thought that this is going to go ahead.
Well, that and, you know, you kind of got to plan ahead for a film.
Yeah,
to be
exactly. But it was actually held for a while with the BBFC because they wanted further input from the Catholic Church. So again, I mentioned about Amy Whitehouse
I did not know that.
And the Catholic Church were the ones who eventually said, you cannot go ahead and make this film.
Christ, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's not like they had a choice. We either make this one or this one. It's we cannot, categorically cannot make this film. So we're left with The Curse of the Werewolf, which is based on Werewolf in Paris.
Yeah, the novel.
The novel.
Yeah.
And they have a Spanish set, so...
They just basically adapted the script for a Spanish setting, didn't they? I mean, like, you know, I don't blame them.
No.
You've already got the bloody sets built.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can't blame them at all.
And if you think, as an example, this film and The Rape of Sabina... In 1959, in Britain, they brought out the Obscenes Act.
Go on, and talk me through that, because I'm not aware of the Obscenes Act. I know censorship is your bread and butter, so to speak. I did say to you via text when we were planning this before, then I was like, there's a lot of censorship in regards to the werewolf. So I'm expecting you to be like a pig in shit for this podcast.
I was quite disappointed that I couldn't find a formal document with the communications and discussions surrounding the film. So unfortunately, it is pretty much from accounts rather than a definitive BBFC letter. So the Obscenes Act, or the Obscenes Publication Act of 1959, essentially gave power to justice officers to be able to go in and seize and cease and desist and seize property.
Are we talking about any form of medium here or just film?
Any form of medium.
Like film, newspapers, books.
Yep.
Shit, man.
Everything.
Essentially just employ the Gestapo, basically.
Well, censorship can be seen as a form of propaganda anyway. You're censoring what can be said.
Yeah, and yeah, you kind of go down that route a little bit too much and you're talking North fucking Korea, aren't you?
Well,
not to that extent, but you know what I mean. If you keep doing that, you are essentially, you're just a controlled state.
Yeah, pretty much.
It is essentially like North Korea is living at the moment.
And there's no expression from it.
Or freedom of speech for that matter.
Yeah. And I mean, we have laws in regards to freedom of expression, freedom of speech, to, inverted commas, protect people in society.
Yeah.
So one case in point is relevant to the Obscene Publication Act, although it relates to Northern Ireland and parts of the Republic of Ireland. When an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation was released, there was a line in there talking about the unification of Ireland happened in this date. This was in the 90s.
Yeah, when it was, there was a lot of trouble.
You had the troubles.
I'm saying a lot of trouble. I'm putting that very, very lightly.
Yeah.
Like, I can't express the severity of the situation that was going on at the time.
The only way...
it blasé to say, like, oh, there's a bit of a situation. Don't misconstrue my words, because it was quite a serious matter, to be fair, if you are listening.
You were 100% accurate, because that period of time is known as the Troubles.
That's quite funny. It just sounds like something Dougal would say.
There's a lot of troubles. That episode was said not to air on TV within Northern Ireland and parts of the Republic, which can be seen as a form of censorship. But again, if we go by the BBFC's ruling of to not cause offence to a greater proportion of the population or a minority within the population, because both Northern Ireland and Republic are very strong in their mindset of where they, well, at the time, where they stood.
Yeah.
Probably
still is. We just don't hear about it as often in the news anymore. So yeah, basically they went ahead with this film because the set was built. There's no other way of putting it. That's the only reason this film came to be.
And they employed a fantastic tactic to try and get it passed by the BBFC.
Yeah, this, I will admit, is a ballsy move. Like, the brass cojones on these guys, fair play. Is it James Hines basically said to Terence Fisher, it's fine, just they're only chatting bollocks, basically.
Anthony Hines,
yeah. Sorry, my bad. They're only chatting nonsense, they're never going to follow through on it. Just make the film as it is. Despite the fact that it'll be banned, the BBFC has said it'll be banned for exhibition, in the UK. Just go ahead and make it anyway. And then when it was submitted to the BBFC for classification, he conveniently decided to take a holiday.
But do you know where he sent?
Go ahead.
The film in black and white.
Oh yeah, I did read that. And then they turned around and they were like, absolutely not, send it to us in colour.
They were like, we've seen what happens here. Send in colour. Oh, we will not.
You just imagine our phone could be like, come on, mate. Like, come on. Really? Unless we spoke about it, especially in the Curse of Frankenstein episode. Like, the colours in a Hammer film and associated with a Hammer film are always very bright, very vibrant. Yeah. Even the blood looks almost arterial blood, isn't it? It's a bit darker, a bit more vibrant. It's always that type of blood.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking like George Romero's films, for example, where the blood was like very red, should we say, his early films.
Well, especially Dawn of the Dead.
Is they a lot more realistic looking than some of the other horrors we've had previously?
Yeah. You know, there wasn't blood dripping from an anonymous source onto, you know, the name of a character. There wasn't...
That was still such a good fucking opening. Let's be honest.
There wasn't, like, a barbaric dismemberment and then rubbing blood on your own overalls like in Frankenstein. And there wasn't blood coming out of someone's eye.
Or blinding them.
Yeah, or blinding them in the process. There is blood. There's like a fleeting moment where you see the most blood on his hands.
Yeah.
But it's covered by his fingers. But we'll get into
details. Like, stop talking, Mike. Stop talking. We'll go into this in a minute. So the board director, John Trevelyan, was pissed, basically, because they essentially ignored the BBFC. I think this is why the film gets ruined, essentially, let's be honest.
Yeah.
It's because they wanted to make an example out of them. They were like, well, you've just ignored everything.
Essentially, when they requested all of the cuts to happen, you're looking anywhere between 5 and 12 minutes totally cut from the original theatrical release just to get the X certificate rating at the time.
That is obscene.
But it takes considerable chunks from those scenes. Like we said when we were talking about Curse of Frankenstein, the drop in the head didn't impact the scene all that much.
It wasn't an integral point.
No, we knew what was happening.
You know it's there, you know it's happened. It's not vastly going to affect the story. From what I understand, some of these were like, it literally just went from one scene to the other, and they were like, okay, how the fuck did she get there?
Yeah.
Or how did that happen?
What happened to those characters then? As an audience, we didn't get to see an almost uncut version until 30 years later.
Here's a BBC broadcast. The Universal's restored version of the film in 1992.
Yeah.
Yeah, people were just like, what on earth is this? I've never seen this before.
It was then broadcast again in 1995 as part of this other show, which starred Guy Henry. But they accidentally aired the theatrical version, which has the cuts, even though it was supposed to be the uncut version. Little tidbit. Guy Henry went on to play Moff Tarkin in Star Wars Rogue One and had Peter Cushing's face superimposed over the top of him.
Weird bit of trivia.
Yeah. He's a fantastic actor as well.
Oh, yeah. Hands down.
Yeah.
So, go on then, Mike. What was actually cut here? Because there was quite a few substantial cuts they were asked to make.
Yeah. I'll do what we did with The Mummy, and I'll come in when we get to the scenes and just talk about some of the things that were
That makes sense. Yeah. I suppose it's better than going through all of them now. Yeah, at the end of the fucking podcast, basically. Thank you for listening, folks. That was a quick podcast, Mike.
Got all the important stuff out at the beginning.
I do think one thing before we go into the film, we were chatting before, it turns out we've actually watched two different versions of the film.
Technically the same cuts, but I watched the...
Well, two different releases,
two different releases. I watched the, I think it's 2020 Scream Factory 4K restoration.
That's the one on Prime at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you watch the Final Cut Entertainment?
Yes. It was the Blu-ray release I got.
Yeah, the UK.
Yeah, I've had it for a couple of years now,
I'm pretty sure the 4K restoration Scream Factory was a Blu-ray, but it was Region A.
The one thing I picked up on this, like, there was some really cool featurettes and some extras on there, but there was no subtitle option.
Yeah.
Like, I was a bit like, if I was deaf, I'd be fucked.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's probably one of the only DVDs or one of the only pieces of physical media I own that doesn't have subtitles. I was gobsmacked.
Yeah, it's kind of like a norm now, isn't it, having subtitles with everything.
So, anyway, Mike, the film. So you're open straight away onto Hammer Film Production.
In white.
Yeah, this was a bit of an odd choice for me. It just didn't fit the norm, should we say. The font wasn't even that gothic.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
It was a bit like, okay. It's the
PowerPoint presentation you would have done in school.
But this one didn't have all the fancy animations on it.
That's true.
That is what got me my A's. Those fancy little animations.
It wasn't the content.
It wasn't the content, it's the fact that I made the title like Wiggle or Twerk or whatever. Anyway, yeah, we're talking about the film here. Yeah. Like, the font, it wasn't very in keeping with Hammer's previous films.
And when you think, like, the main monsters, especially with Universal, now with Hammer, we've had Frankenstein, we've had Dracula, we've had the Mummy, now we're going into the Wolfman. You would think, I mean, it's not even a big thing, but it threw me off completely because I forgot that the text was white.
But then this, again, for me, this is another argument of why this is probably one of my favourite werewolf films. It is remarkably unique as a werewolf film. As a horror alone, it's remarkably unique. I can't think of another film that's, like, massively similar to this. Like, can you think of, and don't even bring up an American Werewolf in Paris.
Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to bring
it up. I was going to say, can you think of another werewolf film that's been set somewhere like Spain?
I can think of a werewolf set in Canada.
Can you?
Yeah, Ginger Snaps.
Oh, I fucking hate that film.
What did he say?
But I thought of Ginger Snaps whilst watching the, like, rewatching the film today.
Yeah.
Because they talk about, oh, as he's growing older, and he's hitting puberty, he's, you know, love is the thing that's going to save him.
Yeah.
And Ginger Snaps, they hit puberty and menstruating, and that's what brings a werewolf to Ginger. The person who loved her kills her to save her.
Yeah, you can see it in that aspect.
Yeah. Not, like, they're not identical in any way.
Oh, no, they're vastly different films. One's good and one's not.
But to go back to your point about it being in Spain, the superstition that they discuss is predominantly a northeastern
Eastern European, isn't it?
Where, you know, you're looking like Poland, you're looking Scandinavian countries where somebody born in the first hour on the 25th of December.
But again, this is another reason why I love this film so much. It's not, it doesn't go into the normal folklore and mythology surrounding a werewolf that, like, has been the norm since Universal's The Wolfman.
Yeah, it doesn't touch on anything Universal has already said, even though they had the right to copy Universal.
Oh yeah, Universal were involved in this, weren't they? That's a ballsy move to make such a different film to The Wolfman.
Well, they essentially did it with Frankenstein and Dracula when they didn't have it, but The Mummy, as we talked about in our third episode, there are points in there where you can tell the influence.
Oh, God, yeah, 100%.
And in this, they essentially go, well, we're going to make a tragic character, similar to Lawrence Talbot, but we're not doing what you did.
Don't get me wrong, I love The Wolfman, the original. But yeah, there's like nothing, as we said at the start of this podcast in the intro, there's nothing happy in this.
No.
Like, there's no, you know, at least for some of the previous films we covered in our previous episodes in this series, there's been brief moments of, you know, lighthearted, comedic.
Yeah, a bit of respite.
Yeah, a bit of a respite from the intensity and the horror you're, you know, seeing on screen.
Yeah.
But this, there is no redeeming qualities. As I said, there's,
when you say redeeming qualities, you just mean the positive.
Yeah, like, I don't mean, you know, redeeming as in this was a shit film. This is probably, as I say, my favorite, one of my favorite werewolf films. Again, another reason I love this film so much, I can't think of another film, another werewolf film particularly, where we got this caliber of cast. Oliver Reed, man.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible performance in this.
Oh, yeah, brilliant.
And we don't even see him for, like, the first three quarters of the film.
Yeah, it's like the first 50 minutes he's not in it.
Yeah, obviously you don't see, this film is called Curse of the Werewolf. We don't actually see the full werewolf, the full shot of him, until, like, 45 minutes plus into this film. It's something along that.
Well over an hour.
It's over an hour.
Yeah, well over an hour into it. Yeah, well over an hour.
Which is, in its own right, that's quite mental if you actually think
considering
about
it's about 1 hour, 27 minutes.
Yeah, it's, well, give or take about an hour and a half, isn't it?
We build up the relationship with the characters.
But again, this is where the censors fucked the film up, basically. Because they cut out a lot of the stuff with the titular monster.
Yeah.
And from the credits then, we go into, well, our first glimpse of the monster, basically.
The eyes.
Yeah, the eyes.
The credits were on top of the
eyes. Iconic shot over the eyes, where this threw me as well, because you basically sat there watching the credits roll over a werewolf crying.
Yeah.
It's kind of like giving the audience, like, this isn't going to be a happy film.
And just from, you know, that close-up, like we said, we don't see a full shot of him till well over an hour in, but we see this close-up of his eyes, and as you said, he's crying. It's the juxtaposition of what we perceive to be a monster showing human emotion, which is leading into, well, the theme throughout of duality of man. You know, there is good and evil in everyone.
Yeah. So, yeah, we go straight into the film, and It starts off with the narration. Turns out to be Alfredo, played by Clifford Evans.
Yeah.
Love the fact that the Welshie's got a representative
yeah.
in this film as well.
Yeah.
Very well known. Yeah, so the narration starts and this beggar's basically coming into this... is this Santa Vera, the name of the town?
I think so.
Yeah. In search of charity.
Well, he's referred to as the beggar.
Didn't even give the poor bastard a name. And he's quite
like Frankenstein's monster.
Who are you? He never gave me a name.
But I will be fair, this is one film that Mel Brooks hasn't managed to win. He never did a werewolf film.
No, he didn't.
No. I mean, arguably, Wes Craven's Curse is probably the most comedic werewolf film we're going to get, and that's just because it was a fucking mess.
Yeah.
but I don't blame Craven for that. I blame the... It's, yeah, it was a Weinstein's, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's the studio yeah. again.
Pricks.
Wow.
So the beggar.
Yeah, the beggar. Can't be a chooser. Oh, you gotta love a dad joke, haven't you? yeah, he comes into this town basically looking, and he goes into the tavern, and very much like anyone who votes nowadays, when he comes in looking for charity, they're like, oh, don't go speak to us, go speak to the rich folk over there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we've given all their our charity to them. And that one guy turns around and, like, ringleader, didn't he, in there?
Yeah.
And is like...
We have nothing to spare, my friend. That's where all our charity has gone. You want some of it, you'd better go there. And God knows, I wish you luck.
Like, just sends, you know, he knows what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Is it the Marquez?
Yeah.
Marquis?
Well, as soon as they said Marquez, I thought, oh, Christ, just like Desaad. And then, you know, when we do see him, he's quite sadistic.
Oh, he's a prick.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a proper piece of work.
Yeah.
It speaks volumes when he goes up to this castle.
Yeah.
And even the servant's like, go before he sees you.
Yeah.
And, of course, he doesn't.
Between that tavern scene and the beggar played by Woodsworth, who we would have seen in Quatermass as one of the pilots who, well, the pilot that had crash-landed and then starts to
malform. Oh, yeah, I forgot he was in
there. Seeing him again in this. Before him knocking the door, we have that moment of the chefs coming out with all the food. Everyone cheering and jeering.
I just going to interrupt you there. Where the hell did Hammer find these kids? They're terrifying. They're up there with Children of the Corn and...
Children of the Damned.
That's the other one I was looking for. I don't know what it was, but there was one or two that stood out more than the others. So I was like, oh, this is freaking me out. I don't even know why.
I think it was the two holding up the goose.
Yeah, one of them had an abnormally long neck.
Yeah, that was the goose.
Yeah, that was a weird way to present the goose. Very upper class way, should we say?
Yeah, like old
making like a spectacle out of it.
Yeah, and with that scene, we realise why the bells are tolling not on a Sunday, why nobody's working, why everybody's celebrating. They're being told to celebrate.
The big burly bearded man.
Yeah. Is that what you wrote down as a description?
I did. Much like I did for the Mummy, the Scary Red Hat Man. Big bearded burly man. So then we go into the castle, and it's a pretty impressive set, to be fair.
Yeah, as always, pull up no stops. But when it has like a few of the long shots or, you know, establishing shots within there, I kept thinking, where have they used that before?
They reused a lot of their sets, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, we talked about with Dracula how they redressed it for a graveyard. Yeah. They dressed it for one room, they dressed it for a library, they dressed it for another room. But like the big grey breeze blocks behind the chefs bringing the food in reminded me of the big breeze block walls that were in Curse of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
But it was the floor that I couldn't quite figure out where it was. It's like a chessboard with all squares, but there's like a compass in there as well.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out where else that was in, well, the films that we've explored in the previous episodes.
I think the only way we're going to be able to do that is if we watch every Hammer film back to back from like the Quatermass all the way through to like fucking, was it the latest one, Dr. Jekyll?
Yeah.
Through to that. I think it might take us a while, Mike, to be honest.
I mean, Mr. Gore, if you want us to go through the entire archive to find what's good and what's not.
Anyway, back to the curse.
It's where we see the first time, you know, how barbaric, how inhuman the Marquess could be.
Why have you prepared goose when the Marquesa doesn't like goose?
My lord, I didn't know.
Why didn't you know?
Have mercy.
But it's a credit to Anthony Dawson. At some point, he sounds a bit camp, and he looks like he's going to act a bit camp, and then he just shoots a stare, or he moves, or he changes the tone of his voice.
Well, it's when he notices his newlywed wife being a bit off-put by the presentation of the goose.
Goose?
Don't let be silly!
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just... the tone just switches from, like... Yeah. I wouldn't say happy, but, like, happy for them.
Yeah.
And, like, laughing and joking, then one hit and the tone of the entire room changes.
Yeah, because, I mean, he even stops all of his peers.
Yeah, throws the goose down on the floor.
Yeah.
And then throws the cook down on the floor with it. And he's, like, pick it up.
Yeah.
They weren't laughing with him when they were, like, making him dance. And well, even turns around, he's, like, singing. He's, like, I can't sing. Or, like, dance. Everyone can dance.
Oh, with a pulling the head down.
They are just whipping the shit into him.
Yeah.
And he's none the wiser.
He's already been paid for at this point.
Well, bought as a pet, basically.
Well, he sold himself.
I know, I would have asked for more than 8 pesos.
Well, he was excited. you know, all he wanted was food, and they were like, no, give him some wine.
It's even to the point that they don't even give him food, like proper
from
food.
From the table, it's
they
a
just
scrap.
Give him fucking scraps like a dog, man.
Yeah.
Even my dog gets more to eat than that big
Yeah,
it's a difficult watch.
He's essentially just eating kind of like the cartilage off the bones.
It's the bits of, you know, after a chicken leg has been eaten, it's whatever's remaining on there.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, back in the day, they'd have, like, boiled it off and taken the meat off the bones and made stew and God knows what else. But, like, it's basically not a lot left for him to eat off that.
No.
And then, obviously, it all goes completely literally south when he makes that comment. Well, I don't even think it was a bad comment.
Have a good night. You're insolent.
Don't forget he's mine. A wedding gift for my husband. I don't want my gift to be damaged.
He just throws him into the dungeon, forgets about him.
Yeah.
The only person that did remember him, he's such an asshole to her that she dies early because she just simply can't deal with his bollocks anymore.
No.
So yeah, and then obviously we go into the next part of the film where he's thrown in jail. And it was a very good thing, as I said, in with The Mummy. One of the reasons I wasn't a massive fan with the film is it showed, like, if you've got a character going from A to B in a film, you don't need to see the entire journey. It's boring. It is just boring. It's mundane. But this, you saw the highlights.
Yeah.
The highlight reel, so to speak. Whereas in The Mummy, they played it from its entirety from A to B.
In the flashback segment.
Yeah, you don't need the full whack, just the highlights.
Yeah.
You know, that's why Match of the Day is so bloody popular at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, it's essentially the highlight reel. And he goes to this and we see, you know, this narration from Clifford Evans Alfredo over the top.
And so the beggar was imprisoned in the castle dungeon. Time passed and he was forgotten.
All he sees is the jailer, like the person who runs the jail, the jailer, whatever you want to call him, and his daughter, who at that time is a young girl.
Yeah.
He's nice enough to even turn around and be like, oh, you give him the food, he's your friend.
He's your friend, yeah.
And yeah.
But then even in her eyes, she has a sense of fear of him.
But then looking at it, it is basically like a dog would act or an animal would act when you give them a bit. They're gonna...
That's what I was going to say. Like, essentially, he was paid for to be a pet.
Yeah.
They throw him into a cage. The only people he has communication with is the jailer who won't speak to him and a mute daughter. So he has nobody to speak to. So he's essentially becoming feral.
Well, that's exactly what happens, basically.
Yeah.
You know, with the narration and everything, it skips. So you don't need to see the entirety
see the
last.
Of time
you don't need to see the entire passage of the time. You've seen it enough. So we see her grow from a young girl into a fully grown woman now, and she was played by
Yvonne Rumi. We've said it through, you know, the last four films. There is a hell of a lot of acting with facial expression.
Yeah, to be honest, it's really all she's got. She can't talk. She can't.
Oh, exactly.
Like, she's got to be, you know, predominantly through her eyes and her actions and
her
demeanour.
It's the opposite of, say, Claude Rains in The Invisible Man. You don't see facial expressions, so you hear everything through
his
voice.
He had it the easiest. He didn't even have to turn up. Just sat in a recording booth.
Just had to be over the top.
It was great, though, let's be fair. She's not just looking after the beggar anymore.
No.
Because she gets sent up to the Marquez's quarters.
Yeah.
Where it's, as I said previously, it's revealed he's been such a dick, he sent his wife to an early grave.
Yeah.
He's alienated any friends and other people who talk to him. So, yeah, he's just up there alone, rotting, basically.
Yeah.
And I think, we get lights. Jenna obviously turned into the room and we see him, but we don't really get a full glimpse of him. He's behind a house of cards.
Yeah.
And knocks a house of cards over. Oh, he looks hanging.
Yeah.
Like, the makeup was fantastic.
That's one thing I've got to say about this film. How they aged people. Hell of a lot better than what they did in some of the films in the 50s.
Yeah.
In this one, it did look like everybody had gotten older.
Oh, there's one scene, though. I think it's a little bit later on, but when he sat in front of the mirror and he's just, like, picking his, like, boils or scalp. I just sat there like, oh, my God. No, no. Yeah, it's like a slight green tinge to him as well.
Yeah. Like, he's not well.
She, trying to do her work, and in the typical Weinstein fashion, decides he's going to put his moves in on her. But there's no consent, shall we say.
No.
And she obviously declines his advancement.
Yeah.
And that only infuriates him further when she doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
And won't give him his name, or her name, sorry. She bites him, and then bails. He cleans himself up, tends to his wound, goes outside, is like, who was that woman in here? She needs to go, like, kicking off, like, throw her in the dungeon.
It's the dirty old man voice.
The dirty old, hello, Driggle. Right. So, yeah, because she basically turned him down, he throws him in the fucking dungeon.
You're to stay there until you've learned your manners. And to be a bit friendlier.
Fuck, man, this is a horrible scene. This is a really, really horrible scene to watch.
It's the lead up to it that sticks in my head more than the actual insinuation. But it's...
How do you mean?
The fact that, you know, we see his hand first and he comes around, he's more dishevelled than he was before.
He's gone, mate.
Exactly. But he approaches her like an animal approaching somebody, because this is the hand that feeds him.
But he approaches her, I think this is, I'm probably stepping on your point here, but he approaches her like he's curious, like a curious animal.
It's the look in his eyes and the expression on his face. Again, Woodsworth does a really good job here, because when he looks at her like when she brings him food, and then his expression changes when two things are noticed. One, there is no food, and two, there are no bars between
them. Yeah, there's nothing separating them anymore. Biology 101, like, animalistic instincts kick in.
We've already had a hint that he could be...
Yeah.
Perverted, you know, of that persuasion.
Well, that's why you got thrown in there, essentially, in the first place.
And it only made him become more animalistic.
Yeah.
More primal.
It's not a nice scene to watch. And I know, you know, you don't see anything, but the implication is more than enough.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, brings me to our next point, because I think this is one of the first bits that they run into a bit of an issue with censorship here, don't they?
Yeah, so the first issue that they had was in the screenplay.
So what did the original?
So the original screenplay was going to have him more wolf-like.
Oh yeah, his arms are hairy.
Yeah, everything about him is becoming more animalistic.
He's essentially turning into a feral dog, let's be honest.
And they originally intended to have was a form of werewolf, not the same one that we see later on, but kind of like a wolfman type thing.
Sort of like Rick Baker did for the Wolfman of 2010, when the feral creature that bites Anthony Hopkins in the first place.
Probably the first stages of American Werewolf in London, when he starts changing and he's got the hair around
his
head, and, you know, he just looks like a beast rather than a man. So, but not quite a werewolf or a wolfman type thing.
Yeah.
And the character was to rape the servant girl.
Yeah.
BBFC were like, nope. If you were to make that script in its iteration, it would never get approved, as you said earlier.
Yeah.
So they talked them down, and they seemed okay with a man raping a woman, which is what we had in the film.
You know, you don't explicitly see the rape as you do in, you know, some of the later horrendous films, not just Hammer now, like, you know, Deliverance, for example.
I Spit on Your Grave, Irreversible.
I Spit on Your Grave, Irreversible. The one with Jodie Foster on the pin table. But yeah, it's not... is explicit. You don't see anything. There's nothing to make this scene more bearable or to alleviate some of what we've just seen.
No.
Which is essentially a disabled woman get raped.
I think there'll always be a question of how are you going to do it? What's the extent that's going to happen?
Obviously, the repercussions of doing it their way were much more severe back then, because obviously we ended up with a completely different film.
Yeah.
Following on from that pretty horrendous scene, Becca just dies.
Yeah.
Like, there's not really any explanation. We see, obviously, her disheveled and the clothes are a bit tattered and torn and she's looking pretty worse for wear.
Yeah, she's got the scratches across her chest.
Yeah.
There's blood on her clothing. But in the original script, it's written in there that the beggar's face is contorted as if he'd had a fit.
Yeah, there's not really any explanation as to why he dies.
No.
And you were telling me earlier there's a little bit in the script here that alluded to a lot more going on.
The beggar is peering around at her. For a while, he does not comprehend. Then his eyes open wide, and a low growl comes from his throat. He starts to crawl towards her. The servant girl cringes back against the wall. The beggar, whom we see to be even more of an animal than before, reaches out his hairy hands as if to fondle her. The servant girl slides along the wall away from him. The beggar looks surprised. He peers at her for a moment with his bloodshot eyes, then stretches out his hands again. The servant girl slides away until she has reached the corner of the cell and can move no further. There is no scene 72. The beggar is annoyed now. He crouches in front of the servant girl, swaying slightly and growling. The servant girl draws back, leans her hand against the wall, her eyes closed, her mouth whispering a prayer. Then the beggar springs. What little light there is comes from the moon streaming through a small opening in the wall. The servant girl, her face scratched and dirty, her clothes torn and disheveled, crouches huddled in the corner. The camera discovers that this is the beggar, dead, his body twisted, his eyes open, his feet distorted, as if he had died as a result of a fit. The servant girl, panic-stricken, hurls at the bars and shakes at them with all her strength. She is obviously trying to scream hysterically, but the sound will not come.
Whoa. I mean, it was bad enough what we got in the film, but that's even darker, man.
Well, just him moving like an animal on all fours. That's horrible. Like, that's a horrible thing. Like, his face was creepy.
Yeah, that's an image you don't really want in your head, like.
No.
I think that would have been worse.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they loosely followed that script. Yeah, there was not really any back and forth. It was kind of very, like, over very quick, then very suddenly.
Yeah, yeah.
She still doesn't get a break.
No.
Because she gets taken out and I'm like, oh, you've come to your senses now. Go back up to Krusty's room.
Yeah, you know where to go.
Yeah, oh, that line was just...
And it's like, not only are you guys happy with this, you're condoning it, you're joking about it. But then also, like, when she comes out and she's got scratches and stuff on her, they don't care. Like, they look at her and they're like, oh!
And just, oh, you come to your senses, go back up to his room.
Yeah, and it's like, fucking...
Oh, Christ, man. But she gets her revenge.
Yep.
Now, why truly? Takes, it's a candle holder or a lantern holder on a wall,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Takes it off the wall, goes back up and he's full of himself and I've won, basically.
Yeah.
What are you going to do for me now? And she just stabs him multiple times. And there's no cutting away or shying away. Like, this is seen in very explicit detail for a 1960 film.
It was cut, but she was only able to stab him once.
Once.
So I'm assuming, I haven't seen the cut version, but I assume it's the first one in the chest.
Obviously, we both watched this film before we recorded this podcast. She stabs him multiple times.
She's like stabbing the hell out of his back.
Yeah. So I was watching the behind-the-scenes stuff on the Blu-ray I've got.
Huh.
And the actress that played the kind of, wasn't it, Yvonne?
Remain.
That's the one. She was saying there was padding on the actor's back.
Oh,
but she was like, if I missed it, I'd kill him for real. I was watching him like, oh, they blinded Christopher Lee multiple times. They wrecked his shins. Oh, what's next?
Stabbing another actor. Obviously.
Accidentally stabbing another actor. She goes fleeing into the woods then.
Yeah.
And then we get the little bit of narration from Alfredo again.
Yeah.
And he finds her in a lake.
Face down.
Yeah. Weirdly. how the fuck is she alive?
I don't know if you saw her on your copy, but when Alfredo goes to save her, he inadvertently knees her in the face. Well, knees her in the head.
Just to double check she wasn't faking. Just give it a little kick. It's fine.
He's like, are you okay? Boosh.
Well, she was. I did notice. I gotta be honest.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. It did turn out the actress was saying in an interview with her on one of the featurettes on a Blu-ray copy I've got. She was saying it was like mid-November when they shot this.
Oh, so it was probably freezing then.
Yeah, she said it was like Baltic, basically. And the two of them got drenched. She said it wasn't the nicest thing to film, to be honest. So yeah, Alfredo pulls her out.
Yeah.
And, you know, being the nice guy he is, takes her back to his, basically.
Yeah.
And help her recover. And it's only when we get back, you know, we have a bit of a progression of time again. And Teresa, is it?
Yeah, yeah. Here at Telfree.
She turns around and she's like, oh, lucky she didn't lose the baby.
Yeah.
She's pregnant. And it's going to be the feral guys. Or the beggar.
It's the pit in the bottom of your stomach that Teresa's very happy about it. And lucky she didn't lose the baby.
Well, they're both quite religious as well. It turns into it later. More so, but...
You know, the fact that the servant girl is mute, can't say... how the baby
you have this scene shortly after this, don't you, where Teresa's trying to ask her like what's happened and everything, and she's like,
she can't, and she says, oh, you poor thing.
Yeah, and I think she realizes then that, you know, she's a mute, she can't speak.
Yeah,
they're discussing the birth of the baby then, and Teresa's worried because she's like, well, she's about to pop and it's nearly Christmas Day. It's nearly
the first hour of Christmas Day.
This is where the lore and mythology that Hammer have constructed, and obviously partly inspired by the novel this is based on.
And the folklore of Northeast Europe.
This is, you know, their version of a werewolf, basically. Yeah. Vastly different to anything 99% of iterations we've had on film before.
Yeah. Thinking of the main ones prior to this, you have Werewolf of London, the 1935, and then you have the 1940-1941 The Wolfman.
Yeah.
All subsequent sequels that came from it.
Yeah.
But pretty much it's all, ooh, it's the occult and it's this and that. Or
the five-sided star and pentagram and all that. The hand. Yeah.
And then this one you have, well, it's an unfortunate timing. It's not,
well, that,
you
know, and it's,
as we said, nor a product of circumstances.
Yeah, being circumstances in the wrong place. Beyond his control, essentially. Yeah.
He's just born at that time.
Yeah, because that's the whole curse. And we'll bring this back in later because we get like a full explanation from the priest, don't we? Their version of a werewolf is an... If an unwanted child is born on Christmas Day, it's seen as an insult to heaven and to God, and so therefore he's cursed.
Yeah.
And that is, like, you know, the basic mythology behind the werewolf in this film, behind Leon becoming a werewolf in this film.
Yeah. And as you say, with the religious symbolism from it as well, they even make a point, because of course this leads to the servant girl passing away during childbirth, leaving him orphaned and raised by Alfredo. And they say he has no father, he has no mother. You have this servant girl who's mute, who cannot speak or anything like that. They don't know who the father is. The father is no longer there. And then you think of the similarity of, you know, the tolls of Jesus through the Bible and the tolls of Leon through the rest of this film, destined to be the person that he didn't know he was.
This is quite a joyous podcast, isn't it? Like...
It's not a perfect analogy or comparison.
Yeah.
But because it's talking about faith,
it very much leans into the religious aspect of it, should we say. So she's got one of the other servants in there, like, performing, like, sage or some shit they're burning. She's about to give birth. Leave her alone.
Yeah.
And he's burning shit in her face at the end of the day.
I mean, I at first thought she was dead already. She's looking around.
She's very, very still. She doesn't look well.
No. I mean, she ends up dying during the childbirth.
Yeah. You know, I didn't find it humorous, but it alleviated some of the tragedy in that Alfredo is just downstairs just smoking his pipe, chilling.
And it was quite an impressive pipe, I've got to
remember. Yeah, and he decides, like, oh, I can't light it like that, so I'm going to go and use a candle. He lights the pipe multiple different ways. It's pretty impressive. The juxtaposition to what we were just seeing, her struggling through birth, and obviously then you get the howling.
Yeah,
and then outside. Followed by that, you get the baby crying, and he's like, oh, okay, the baby's been born. I don't think he's as invested in the religious side, like, oh my god, this is bad. No. That.
But then we do see earlier, Alfredo is an academic who is reading about the world, and then Therese says, I know more about the world than you know from your books. Kind of like the superstition, traditional side of things, whereas he's all about, once again, another film where they're all about information, facts, academia. Yeah. Another character being that way and thrust into this supernatural setting.
Yeah, you think of that.
Yeah. You wouldn't.
I fucking knew it when I said that. I was like, bollocks. And they cut straight to a newborn with obviously newborn Leon. Goes through things quite quickly and they go to take him to be baptized because they're basically raising him.
Yeah. And a very, very impressive moment.
How raised the level.
Yeah.
Like, it's quite cool how they did this scene.
I was really surprised.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it. Basically, folks, they go into this church and they're baptizing him. And as the priest takes the baby, the light from outside just fucking goes completely into darkness. Thunder and lightning, classic horror tropes.
Oh.
Goes to baptize the baby. The fucking holy water is boiling.
It's just like rippling around it's underneath him. It's amazing.
It's such a cool scene.
I completely forgot about that moment. And when it came up, of course I was paying attention anyway, but I kind of paid attention to that.
Alfredo knows to the extent, because obviously he's quite surprised when the priest gives him the rundown later.
Yeah.
But they just accept and they're like, okay, well, boiling holy water, just christen him anyway, it's fine.
Yeah.
And they just, they carry on.
It's what they said about love. You know, when he's surrounded by love and shown love, it'll suppress the lycanthropy.
Yeah. Another progression of time when we get introduced to the watchman, Pepe.
Yeah.
And he's found a goat, the throat ripped out.
Nasty, that is.
Bumps into Teresa. She's like, well, you can add a kitten to the list as well, because Leon's kitten had his foot ripped out.
Yeah.
We did plan to just do more of a quick overview of Leon as a boy, but, you know, there's quite a few pinnacle bits of the film in these scenes, basically.
Yeah, especially with character development.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. But again, as I said earlier, they go through this pretty quickly. They don't dawdle with it like...
Yeah.
Well, they kind of felt like they did with the mummy.
Yeah. I did feel like we were watching three separate films. Or three
different
acts.
Yeah.
Because we focused... Although we focused on different stages of the character.
Yeah.
Preconception, childhood, and then adulthood. Yeah. We're going through someone's existence. Their life.
Yeah. You get the first act with the beggar and the mute girl.
So essentially the father and the mother.
Yeah. Then you get Bert and Leon as a young boy.
Yep.
And then you get the progressive bit, and it goes to Leon as a young adult.
Yeah.
He succumbs to his affliction, as it's described in the film, later in the film. And yeah, it gets the better of him.
Yeah.
There's a few pinnacle scenes in Leon's younger years, this being one of them. He says about his kitten, and Pepe's like, oh yeah, he couldn't stand the sight of blood. But it comes back in later that's when he got the lust for blood.
Yeah, whilst hunting a squirrel.
Leads into our next scene then, where he goes to tell the mayor, and we get introduced, I can't believe this got past me and I didn't even clock it. Who's the mayor played by, Mike?
It's Peter Sellers.
I can't believe I didn't clock that. It literally just went straight over my head.
You didn't even recognise him with his awesome moustache and beard.
Well, if he said something about cheese, I probably would have recognised it.
Cheese?
Basically scolding him like a schoolboy is quite funny, to be fair. So then we go straight into Pepe hunting this apparent... wolf.
Yeah.
Convinced he shot it, and no explanation of that, it just cuts to Leon in bed, sweating, being bandaged up.
It's quite a subtle way of saying they were one in the same.
Yeah. He's having these nightmares and dreaming he's a wolf.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be doing it.
No. And I think it's one of those things in not just this film, although I do think later on Oliver Reed does a fantastic job of showing that conviction of not wanting to be this. So you have that conflict with him within him.
Obviously Alfredo's pushing him at this point to be like, why? Like, what happened? How'd you get out? Finds out he got out the window.
Yeah.
Comes in a bit later, puts bars on the windows and that. But meanwhile, Teresa's taken this bullet out of him and she's taken it back down to Pepe's wife.
Yeah.
And she just bullshits the wife, basically saying, oh, I found it in the tree trunk, he must have missed something.
Oh.
But she knows, you know, he needs that bullet, basically.
Yeah.
As we said previously, there's not a lot in this film to be happy about. No.
It would be prudent to mention that this bullet being special, it's because it was melted down from a silver crucifix.
As I said, we were going to try and, not say gloss over this bit, but we, you know, only going to pick out the bigger bits from this, but there's quite a few pinnacle scenes in this.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of development for the character.
Which takes us into our next scene. I say the full playbook, basically, the full rundown from the priest.
Yeah. Probably the most exposition.
Yeah.
Aside from the first act of the film.
You know, Clifford Evans' performance in this scene alone is fantastic. I think you finally get, you know, the realisation from Alfredo of what Leon is.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he's kind of just taking it all as hearsay.
yeah.
previously.
But again, as a learned man, an academic,
kind of believes in the science, yeah. as opposed to the mythology and folklore.
Whereas we know that Teresa is
the other side of it.
Yeah, fully believing.
You got basically two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And they meet in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, one foot planted in the truth, the science, the fact, yeah. so to speak, and then another planted in, like, okay, let's do what the fuck we like, basically, and let's make our own rules.
I mean, there is that thin veil of, if it gets to a point where we don't know and we can't explain it with science, we then fabricate the answer or fill in the blanks with mythology.
Yeah.
Where mythology dies is when science provides facts. Hammer is, no pun intended, hammering that theme through all of them. Yes, it's supernatural, but the intent from Jimmy Sangster, as well as the rest
you
of the
You want
group,
it to be grounded in reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's getting rid of all the fairy tale elements that Universal had, Jimmy Sangster's words, not mine, and grounding it in some form of, inverted commas, realism.
That's predominant in all their films, I'd
say. Yeah.
I'd probably say, because this is coming up towards the end now of seeing Leon as a young boy. I'd probably say this is where the film starts picking up
yes.
for me.
Yeah.
We go into the final bit now of Leon's childhood, and Alfredo's put bars over his windows.
Yeah.
He's just like a proper nice dad. He's like, ah, that should keep the nightmares away.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, your kid's a fucking werewolf.
He is the nightmare.
Yeah, he is the nightmare.
Put some bars on the door.
So I bit in Watchmen, he's like, yeah, I'm not trapped in here with you. You're trapped in here with me. It's really well done in this bit. You think, you know, you hear the shot and you see Alfredo Tamami. He's like, oh my God, has he gone out the window again? And then it cuts back to Leon at the window. And this is the first time you actually see him as like a feral animal. Yeah.
Starting to transform.
You do think he shot Leon at first, and obviously it turns out he shot the farmer's dog.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the first time we see Leon affected with his condition, affliction, as they say in the film.
Yeah. But then they also demonstrate the instant calm of when Alfredo goes in and wraps his arm around him.
I know.
It's almost like he goes into a trance,
but
he doesn't.
Comes back in, takes him to bed, tucks him in. Parents love, it's
showing love. Yeah.
In its purest form, I'd probably say.
Yeah.
But that's it for Leon as a boy. Like,
yeah,
that's the second act gone. Years progression on. Plague of Maven.
Oh, brother, this guy stinks!
And introducing Oliver Reed in his first leading role, as we said earlier.
Yeah.
Good input.
Did you want me? He has a weird bowl haircut.
We're not going to talk about that. Not going to talk about how I looked the same when I was younger.
Yeah, I had the bowl cut.
So yeah, basically, Lev cured him, he's all good, and he's going off now to find work in the vineyard.
Yeah.
So they're both proud of, you know, well, he's progressed into a man he hasn't fucking killed anyone else.
Yeah.
It just reminded me, have you seen the original Pinocchio?
Yeah.
It just reminded me of when Geppetto sent him to school. I was just waiting for Honest John and Gideon to come in and take him off to Paradise Island, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like, he was very, like, there was like a spring in his step, but it literally just reminded me of that scene in Pinocchio.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree with that.
Moving on. I did pick up on one thing when we do see the vineyard when he first goes into it.
Mm.
As you said in some of our previous episodes, Hammer got a wonderful, I say, trait of putting lovely wide open shots for something in the foreground.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of examples in this bit easily. And it's quite nice to see, I've got to be honest. It's like they don't forget where they come from.
Exactly. And, you know, the cinematography, though, they use, you know, those where the camera's hiding behind something or it moves across with something moving in the foreground and then everything's in the background.
Yeah.
Failed to mention that one of the opening shots, aside from the eyes, are the bells that we see at the end of the film.
And oh, shit, goes they are, aren't they? Bloody hell.
Yeah.
And it does go full circle then, basically.
Yeah, and whilst I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, I'm pretty sure it ends with the clock tower and with something to do with the bells, but also beautiful, like, tracking shot.
Yeah.
Like, just going from left to right around those bells and looking down.
This is very well shot, to be fair. whilst this is vastly different to some of the Hammer films that have come before, you know you're watching a Hammer film.
Oh, yeah. 100%, it has all of the traits that we've seen before. And we mentioned about, you know, the Eastman Technicolor in a previous one. We're talking about how some of the colours are more muted or beige.
Yeah.
In this one with the odd ones popping. But as a result of that, the lighting as well. There is a shot near the end, when we come to it, I will mention it. That is my favourite shot of the entire film because of the framing and how it's lit. And of course, Oliver Reed's performance.
We will come to that. Right now, we're dealing with Leon being splashed by some rich dickhead in a top hat.
Oh yeah, laughs at him as he goes past.
Yeah, what a prick.
Wow.
You know, get a brief introduction to them.
Yeah.
Obviously find out later on there's a lot more happening between Leon and her.
Yeah.
He basically goes in and looking for work, and I wish it was this easy to get a fucking job nowadays.
It took me off guard. Like, I thought that is pretty much...
I was like, whoa.
A handshake and an informal agreement.
Yeah, gentleman's agreement. Huzzah!
Yeah,
basically. How easy would it be just to walk into I want to work here? You look strong. Yeah, I am.
Do you like work?
Yeah. You're hired!
This is where you're working.
Yeah, if only it was that easy nowadays.
Yeah. And to be fair, like, not a bad job. You're just pouring wine into bottles and some labels. And of course, label goes on the outside, wine goes on the inside.
That was a great line. That was an absolutely great line.
I did think I need the label for my belly.
No, I told you to stop pouring wine over yourself.
No, the wine goes on the inside.
But it's, like, this is obviously the first time we get to meet his co-worker as well.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, he's one of the film's lighter moments. He's quite comedic.
I hated the character.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I knew about 10 of these guys in uni and high school. Yeah, and college and that.
I got it. I just hated this character in this film. Because we talked about there's no respite from, you know, the tone of the film and the feel of the film. It's very bleak, it's very depressing. When it finally did come with that character, I didn't want it there.
You were like, no, this, I'm really depressed. I wanted film to continue being depressed.
Yeah.
This brings back to our earlier point of it feels, you know, three separate stories, three completely separate films.
Yeah.
Like three different acts.
With a running...
It's just a running theme through them all, basically. Yeah. One thing that carries it across is obviously the curse that Leon's inflicted with.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the only thing that carries through all three of them.
I mean, you could even say...
Besides Alfredo and Teresa and Leon himself, basically.
Yeah. But then even the first two stories that we have, the preconception and childhood Leon, they're narrated by Alfredo. And then it catches up with, you know, an adult Leon there. You could say they are completely different short stories, but all have something to do with lycanthropy.
But it worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
And that's
very
why it's
well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could take any section out of that and you've got your own short film.
Yeah.
It didn't really need either part of it, except for, say, the silver bullet reference in the middle part. You could have just jumped in at any point.
Well, I'll be honest, the first time I ever watched The Curse of the Werewolf, I think it was on Channel 5, Friday, Saturday night. They used to run quite a lot of weird niche horror films.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it, but I didn't... I only saw from the time Leon was an adult.
Oh, okay. So you missed those first parts.
Tuned in to the film at, you know, probably the more pinnacle, more exciting scenes of the film, should we say.
Yeah.
You know, if you're an out-and-out horror fan, they would be the more exciting scenes of the film.
Yeah,
I just thought it was a really cool short werewolf film.
Oh, fair. So it worked as a contained
100%.
Story, even though, like I say, about the bullet is referenced at how it's created there.
Yeah.
But then, again, they even reiterate that, oh, this person has a silver bullet.
Yeah.
I've got to go ask him for the bullet.
Yeah.
So you don't need to see it before. Granted, it's a very clunky way of doing it.
Yeah.
If you were to do it in a short film. But yeah, no, it's self-contained.
It almost felt like if you were to split it into three episodes of a TV series.
Yeah.
It would be a three-part drama series on ITV. A very good three-part drama series on ITV. Well, not drama, but a horror series. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it works. Like it, yeah. weird. I don't know how. I can't put my finger on exactly how, but it works.
Yeah, it's a strange one because you can have three separate films and people make the connection of how they're related, yeah, even though they're not. But to have a singular film with the ability to break it down into three separate stories that can work, yeah, together and isolated from one another, yeah, I think probably it's impressive. Is one of the few. Yeah, and especially for Hammer, this is probably, like, hat tip to Hines.
Yeah. So Rico is scolding Christina, yeah, and their carriage on the way back from an event they've been to, or a night out they've been to. And, again, just, he's being a massive dick.
Yeah, he's being a massive Chad.
Scolding her for having a headache. Yeah. Basically. Leon and his co-worker, you know, having a bit of back and forth, clowning around. He says to Leon, what are you doing tomorrow?
Oh.
And he's like, well, you can't stay on a Saturday night. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Come out, it's payday at the end of the day. Must celebrate.
And he knows a respectable place.
Yeah, respectable in inverted commas. Because it's essentially a brothel they go to and out. Rico drops Christina off, still being an absolute fucking Chad. You know, Leon's watching from afar as she gets out of the carriage and everything, and you're a bit like, okay, what's going on here? We get the reveal afterwards that they've been having an affair.
Yeah.
Almost like, you know, with Christina and Leon, it's a little bit of a Romeo and Juliet situation going on.
Yeah, the secret lovers who can't be.
Again, sign of the times, fucking class system, basically.
Yeah.
Because Leon's a nobody and Christina...
But that is, it's a strange one, and I feel there is a bit of disconnect. Alfredo's not poor.
No.
He doesn't look poor.
Just comes from a working class background, basically.
Yeah, but, you know, you look at the house, it's nice, he's got a maid, the bedrooms are great, he's, you know, got his kid growing up there as well, so he's not exactly the beggar.
No.
And to be honest, you're a vineyard owner, you have your own business, fair enough, but he doesn't look rich.
Yeah.
The little hovel he keeps going back and forth into doesn't look all that great.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's much of a class difference there, just more societal standard of, oh, she's now engaged to this very wealthy man.
Yeah.
This Rico. Just think of the dowry.
Well, he proper scolds her, didn't he?
Yeah.
Whenever she comes back and he's like, well, you can do better than that.
Yeah.
So then after the full reveal, kind of just goes in to them at the brothel because Leon's like, oh, fine, I'll go in the end.
Yeah.
And Leon's just sat there, like, just not really interested. He doesn't look too well, either.
No, yeah. I can understand why he doesn't look too interested, considering, you know, he's eyeballing Christina.
Yeah.
But then, as you mentioned, he's not looking too well. He's sweating.
Yeah. But this obviously comes into play as to why, when you see the full moon.
Yeah.
And he goes outside, and he's like, oh, I just needed a minute. And then she's like, oh, well, you know, I can make you feel better. Come into my room.
Yeah, you can have a lay down on my bed.
Yeah. Ulterior motives. Yeah. How dare a woman of the night behave like that? So, yeah, that kind of kickstarts. Again, this is... Fuck, like, how long are we into the film now?
Maybe an hour.
Yeah, and we still haven't seen... As I said earlier, we still haven't seen the full... It's Curse of the Werewolf, and we haven't seen the bloody werewolf.
No.
Going into this scene, it might be a bit like, okay, well, maybe we'll get, you know, the full reveal.
And do we fuck?
No, do we fuck? But again, I think it's very well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been great to see him in his full costume. But again, this leads back into the bloody censorship thing, because they ran into issues with this scene, didn't they?
Yeah. They were perfectly fine having a promiscuous woman lying on bed and fondling and kissing.
It was when he bit her they had issues with it.
The initial bite that he does just below the collarbone, and she goes and looks into the mirror, and then the gruesome aftermath of her corpse.
Yeah.
What about smashing her face through the mirror?
Yeah. That was left.
How was that okay?
Just see the aftermath. You know what he's done to her, but it's fine because she's already dead.
But we don't get to... Well, if we were in 1961 watching this in the theatre, we wouldn't have seen the aftermath.
No, you wouldn't even have seen that.
We would have seen her head go through the mirror, but not the bite. That leads her over to the mirror.
Don't really see... Yeah, and that's the only thing you really see, isn't it? And you get the hand, and that's it.
Yeah, and that's the other thing I thought was really well done, because it was almost like...
It was very quick, the way...
It was like a jump scare, wasn't it?
It was, you turn around to scold him, he's not on the bed, bang, hand.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, shit,
that was
okay.
Brilliant.
It's fantastic.
I really liked that. Yeah. And again, the lighting of the room. Yeah. I thought he was going to be, like, standing next to the window or, like, in a shadowy corner or anything.
Yeah.
But no, next shot, boom, the arm's in.
Yeah. No, don't waste any time. Cut by down to Leon's co-worker downstairs, Dominic.
Yep.
Or Dominique, whatever you want to call him. Having, still living his best life.
Yeah.
Pissed as a fart at this point as well. And one of the women's like, well, you need to go find him. You need to go up and get him. So he does what everyone should not do in a horror film. And he basically goes, oh, I'll be right back.
And then he goes off alone.
Yeah. Two red flags. I mean, Randy from Scream would have had a fucking field day with this film.
Yeah.
So he goes to find Leon. Goes up, you know, you see the aftermath. He's pissed as a fight. You don't fucking realise at all. You haven't got a clue what's going on.
Falling across the floor.
Yeah.
Again, this is why I don't like the character being in it.
What, because you see yourself in it?
That.
I was watching it, I was like, shit, this was me at last year's work still, I gotta be honest.
This was me last night.
This is me leaving after the podcast. Werewolf comes out of nowhere and just fucking owns him.
Yeah.
Throws him across the room and everything.
It's like, I was really, again, another part that surprised me, like the smash in the face through the mirror, well,
yeah,
his head or anything. But then, like, you see him ragging him in the shadow, and then he just, like, Bane lifts him over his head and then throws him off
the
side.
I was wondering what would break first. Your spirit or your drunkenness?
That's a lovely, lovely voice.
Screwed. He's dead, basically.
Yeah.
No two ways about it. And we cut to, you know, the tavern then. The farmer's called Dominique.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. And he's, again, pissed as a fart. And he's raving on about his dog and how he's such a good boy and he never did anything wrong.
Yeah.
And the tavern owner's like, yeah, I know, but I had to shoot him.
Yeah.
Tough, basically tough. And this, again, for me, this is another fantastic scene.
We've actually seen this actor before.
Have we?
Yeah. George Woodbridge. He played the landlord in Dracula.
Oh, the one with the bar wench. He was chasing his daughter out.
So we've seen him there.
Bloody hell.
He also is a recurring character through the Dracula series as the landlord.
I did not know that.
But he also plays the police constable in The Mummy.
Bloody hell.
He's also in a couple of other Hammer films, but we'll get to them when we get to them.
Yeah. Have patience, listeners.
But whilst I was rewatching earlier, I was thinking to myself, I recognise him from somewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, a stern face, but then, again, it's something about, you know, the actors in Hammer films just portraying so much with their face.
Yeah.
You know, with the way their eyes move, way their face moves. A lot of these are character actors anyway, talking about both male and female actors here. But they portray so much. And in this scene, as he's walking away and he's hearing noises.
He's fantastic.
And he's looking around. It's brilliant. It was so eerie.
It's the shots for me where he's like, you got a wide with something in the foreground. Again, classic Hammer trope.
Yeah.
Fantastic shot. But then you got close-ups. And I was literally sat, because I, admittedly, it's been a little bit of a while since I've watched a film. I was watching it like, shit, something's going to jump out. Like, something is literally going to jump out right now. And then it builds and builds and builds. And it's not till that very last shot where you see the silhouette come up next to him on the roof and you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Like, he's
dead. Next.
He's screwed.
Yep.
And it's, you don't see anything, but fuck, man, the screams are horrible.
Yeah.
Like, blood-curdling screams now.
And it's the first, technically the first point we see a full body of the werewolf.
Like the full silhouette of him.
Yeah, in the entire film.
It is a hell of a good shot, mine. That little
pan
up to the silhouette of the werewolf. Like
the lighting that they have there, the performance from Woodbridge as he's walking, the soundscape that's going on.
Yeah.
And you've already seen what happened to his co-worker.
The best way I can describe this scene is the raptor scene in Jurassic Park.
Clever girl.
the build up, and then by the time he realizes it's too late.
Yeah.
And then that's it, that's all you get is the silhouette and the screams. And then it cuts to Alfredo at home and you're a bit like, why the hell is it? Why are we seeing Alfredo? It's only then when he's walking through and he overhears something and he goes into Leon's bedroom and he sees Leon like tossing and turning in his bed sweating.
The thing that I did think about here, we've seen his bed at his workplace at the vineyard. It made me think of, you know, well, made me think of a lot of things, but the Gears of War 4 trailer came out called Tomorrow, and you have a character running through the trees.
Yeah.
He's being chased by something, and you see the muzzle flares going off of his Lancer, and he runs, a tree collapses, he jumps over it, and then shoots at something, and the muzzle flare shows a carving on the tree.
Yeah.
It's parallel edited with the character from 1 to 3, Marcus, Phoenix, and Anya, who are a love interest, with a child that she's holding, putting the child down, and the child runs to Marcus, who's carving into the tree something. So it has parallel editing with it. So it's essentially telling you that JD Phoenix, the child, grows up into the adult and runs to the safest place that he could.
Yeah.
As a child, it's going from his mother's arms to his father, and he picks him up there. So what does he do? He runs home. And a long-winded way of saying, he is still that same child who sees protection in what you mentioned earlier, the unconditional love.
Yeah.
So what did he do when he transformed? By the end of the night, he ran home.
Yeah, basically.
It was a beautiful moment.
It's fantastic. And, you know, Alfredo's there, he's like, well, how the fuck did you get in?
Yeah.
It's when he turns and he actually, the severity of the situation hits him.
Yeah.
And he looks at the window and you just see that pan and the bars are just fucking ruined.
But they're broken in.
Yeah, they're broken in and not broken out.
Yeah.
Which, again, another fantastic touch because, as you say, he's going back to where he feels safest, essentially.
Yeah.
And where he feels most loved, so.
And it's almost like it's telling you that even though he's transformed, he's still inside.
Yeah.
Which again, like I say, it's beautiful having some, you know, that innocence to run back to and that safety net that you have, and it makes it even more heartbreaking, more of a tragedy, is that he's still inside that shell.
Yeah.
That's not him, but it is him. Like, we go back to the duality of man again.
Yeah. I think the, you know, the realization hits Leon in this scene as well.
Yeah.
Because he looks down, he sees blood on his hands, and he's like, what have I done?
Yeah, yeah.
And then that, again, leads into our next scene, where basically he gets told what the hell's going on.
And it's probably one of the most powerful,
The lead is on point in this one, man. Yeah. Like, Jesus Christ, what a performance. You just want to, like, hug him and give him a beer and be like, it's going to be okay, bro.
Yeah. And all he wants is to die.
Yeah.
He's found out what he is.
It did. It starts with, no, 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 then there is. Yeah. As I said, this is going, like, much deeper than some of the other films we discussed, because there is there's nothing to make this better.
No.
There's no two ways about it. You're an animalistic murderer, basically.
Well, you look at and quite a lot of the other ones, you know, like The Wolfman. I need to find a cure. I want to stop hurting people. Okay.
Whereas he's like, I just need somebody just
to kill me. Need to kill me.
So obviously Leon is like completely and utterly horrified by this. The priest, bless him, and this scene is he's just trying to make him feel better. It's like, it might be from an animal.
Yeah.
And Leon is equally horrified and disgusted. Yeah. He's like, with these hands I killed an animal, and he's like, oh fuck, man, why did you say that? You just made me worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no coming back. Leon knows the severity of the situation. And that's when he's like, what do I do?
Yeah.
And the priest turns around and he's like, you need to be chained and watched 24/7. And that's when he loses it and he's like a wild animal like I am, basically, and just storms out. Goes back to the vineyard, weirdly. But
before we get back to the vineyard, I do want to say, I absolutely hated him running. That was like
The bit in Footloose where he throws the hissing, this is really angry dance, isn't it?
It's Cindy in Scary Movie saying, oh, I can be hysterical, and then running away. Yeah, it really took me out of the moment. I just had like a fantastic performance, and then you see him running.
It's bits of it, but then I see the bit where he like falls down, he breaks down.
I like that.
Back into good performance again.
I like that.
It was just the sheer ridiculousness of him running. It was just a bit over the top.
It made me think of Nick Cage in A Vampire's Kiss, where he's going, aah!
I mean, Nick Cage is a fucking god. We will not have any ill words spoken about Nick Cage on this podcast, I will have you know. Thank you very much, Mike.
I do love Nick Cage.
Who doesn't love Nick Cage? Yeah, the running wasn't great, I will admit. But it goes back into, again, I'd say that's like barely a hiccup or a road bump in the pretty solid road that is this film.
Like I said earlier about Oliver Reed, his overall performances are fantastic.
He just has moments
where it's not that great.
I think everyone, to be honest, I don't think there's one actor that could say I've been predominantly fantastic in every single thing I've ever done. Police are already there. The authorities are already there investigating.
Yeah.
They question him a little bit. He's a bit standoffish. Even the vineyard owner starts to fucking have a go at him for going to a brothel.
Yeah.
Leon says, oh, but did my co-worker come back? And he's like, well, I don't know where he is. It's like, oh, probably in prison. You should be there too. It's a bit like, oh, bloody hell, man, chill out.
You don't even know what I've done.
I know. He doesn't know I've killed anyone.
Yeah.
One of the few light-hearted moments in the film where he asks, like, oh, did anything happen? You know, what did I do? And he's like, oh, I don't care, and then scolds him again.
I think this was Ewan Sullen's last Hammer film as well.
Was it?
He was in, like, Hounds of the Baskerville and stuff. But again, like, bit parts and one, like, the main character or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think this was the last one. Oh, it was good, mate, though.
Waste no time in getting back into it now. And it cuts straight to a full moon. Leon is like trying to fight being transformed, basically.
Yeah.
And this is where we get, again, Christina coming back in. She finds him. He's basically like, get away from me.
Yeah, he's trying to protect her.
Yeah, and a bit of difficult when he goes to run off, then Leon knocks himself out.
Oh, yeah, and then he falls backwards down the stairs.
But again, this is a massive, massive key scene. Because he obviously knocks himself out and he awakes hours later. Mm. Questions Christine and is like, what happened? Did I change?
Yeah.
Did I change? She's like, no, you're just tossing and turning. And he realizes that, oh fuck, okay, my parents love me enough unconditionally. That worked. I didn't change with her.
Yeah.
She's my ticket out of here.
Yeah.
Like, I can be okay as long as I stay with her.
Probably the simplest way of it, is it. But again, it's what they said earlier about the unconditional love from a person that they love as well. So it's kind of like a mutual thing between them, and also a saving grace that he can be the man that he wants to be.
Yeah.
Emphasis on man.
Man, not wolf.
Yeah.
So this leads into the start of the film's climax.
Yeah.
He turns around and is like, okay, marry me, we need to leave now, today. Okay, she agrees.
Yeah.
She goes off to collect her stuff, he starts gathering his stuff. As he leaves, no, you ain't going anywhere, mate.
Yeah, the police arrive again.
Yeah, it cracked me up how they arrest him, because the police officer turns around and he's like, you must accompany me. And I was just sat there and I was like, dude, they'd have just hit him in the face and put him in handcuffs at this point. If we were living in nowadays, like.
But, nowadays, it would have been like, you're nicked.
Truncheon back of the head. Yeah, it took me aback a bit. Like, police were a lot politer back then. Because he turns around and says, you need to accompany me, but I am arresting you for a murder charge.
Yeah.
Which,
it's very civil.
Yeah, people aren't so civil when they're arresting a murderer. For the obvious reasons, to be fair.
It's not like, you know, he opened the door and he's like, yes. And they're like, he's got a gun!
That would have led to a very different conclusion of the film.
Yeah.
A very abrupt ending in this scene, put it that way. So, he gets nicked. Ends up going to, accompanies them to jail.
Yeah.
This is intercut with Christina going and getting her stuff. And, you know, she goes to meet Leon and she's confronted by her father and Rico.
Yeah.
Basically, we scold her, find out what's going on, scold her for saying she's going to run away. And I got to tip my hat off to her. The balls on this girl.
Yeah.
Can I have a lift into town?
Yes. Yeah, can you take me to him?
I'm not marrying, I'm leaving you, but can you give me a lift to town?
Absolutely not.
And then the fact that she runs out, locks them in, runs out, is like, I told you to rush me to the town, and the guy just goes.
And he's deaf, because he's not hearing them shouting, like, through the little window. And he even takes the time to do a U-turn.
I mean, to be fair, have you tried having a conversation with somebody when their horse is galloping in front of you?
They weren't really galloping, they were more like slowly turning.
They wear fucking steel shoes, mate. They're clip-clopping everywhere.
It's sand.
Still makes a noise.
Tell that to a quiet place.
Ask the Tuscan Raiders. They'll know, and they, you know, stay in single file to hide their numbers. So we come back to Alfredo and the priest talking to Leon in prison. And he's basically like, you need to kill me, you need to do it before nightfall, you need to go to the mayor.
Yeah, you need to go to the mayor and tell him that he has to be killed in a specific way.
Which is quite dark and quite macabre, to be fair.
Especially considering he's willing to have it done.
And the whole scene ends with him saying the words, burnt alive, that's it.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to them with the mayor. They're basically trying to talk him through it and what's going on.
Yeah.
What's happening. He doesn't believe him. And he even turns around then and he scolds the priest. He's like, you knew about this?
Yeah.
And he gives the priest shit. And the priest then turns around and he's like, well, just give him to me. I'll take him to a monastery and he can be cared for. He can be looked after properly there. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
May just shuts him down well and truly.
Yeah, he should have a trial. At the very least.
Yeah, he's trying to be very diplomatic about it, to be fair. But then he turns round and he's like, well, if he's still in this city after Sunset, he can't be held responsible for what he does.
Yeah.
Which
I thought was a very good line.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Because you're like, okay, what the hell's going to happen? Yeah. Whatever they know, Leon knows. The mayor clearly doesn't bloody know.
Yeah. And we as an audience know, because we saw that he's capable of bending bars and to break into somewhere. So he's perfectly capable of breaking bars to get out.
Bending bars, baning people over the top of him, shoving heads through mirrors.
Yeah.
He's going the full hog here, to be fair.
Yeah.
He's an animal, basically. Yeah. He's a fucking wolf.
Yeah.
So after all this, Maid still doesn't believe him. So he's like, right, take me to the jail, let's go and see Leon.
Yeah.
The sheer stupidity of the mayor in this scene is, like, staggering.
Yeah.
Asking him, he turns around, he's like, show me your teeth.
Yeah.
Show me your hands. It's nonsense, like.
A great moment that happened just beforehand when they walked in and he called Leon's name to come talk to him. Leon's sitting on the edge of a bunk bed,
right
at the bottom. And then he stands up and the camera continues and you see the old guy in the cell with him just like sit up behind him like they've been spooning on the bed.
How dare you disturb us? Giggling. It shouldn't have been funny, but it was.
Yeah. It was just situational.
But yeah, like this whole scene when he turns around, he's asking like, he's basically like an idiot asking like, okay, can you show me you're a dog or not?
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
It's like, he knows the superstition.
Yeah.
You know, he obviously believes the priest. He believes the priest, you know, to an extent. So surely you would know that, it's in the middle of the day, mate.
Yeah.
He's not going to have the characteristics.
Well, ideally.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Hopefully not, like. So at this point, Christina comes running in.
Yeah.
And this threw me back a bit, because she's, you know, besotted with Leon, in love with him, says she's engaged to be with him.
Yeah.
And then it turns out she knows absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Like, even, is it the mayor turns around like, well, do you think this is just a perfectly normal individual then?
Do you know about his affliction?
And, yeah, she's like, oh, I'm none the wiser.
Yeah.
And that is when the mayor's like, well, he's obviously bullshitting.
Yeah.
So he just says he can stay here and he's standing trial.
Yeah. And it's like, again, you know, you have that moment of, oh, the unconditional love is there.
But it's being denied.
Yeah. Basically. And they're also separated by bars, which is reminiscent of his mother and his father in the cells. But there was no unconditional love there. So it's almost like a mirror of what's going on. Like we said about the bells at the beginning and the bells at the end. You know, it's coming full circle in some way, shape or form.
That's deep, Mike.
Ta.
So they make Christina leave, the priest goes with her, and the priest basically tells her what's going on.
Yeah.
And she doesn't believe him.
And takes her back to Alfredo's estate.
Yeah. And nice enough, he turns around and he's like, oh, this is friend of Leon's.
Yeah.
But when they left the jail as well, one thing we didn't touch on is Leon is so, like, he doesn't want this to happen because he knows if he turns again, he's going to kill multiple people again.
Yeah.
So he turns around as his father leaves and says, the Watchman's got a silver bullet, go and get a silver bullet. So Alfredo, that's now his prerogative, his mission. Yeah. He goes and gets his silver bullet.
Teresa asks where Alfredo is.
Yeah.
To Christina, and she says, oh, it's something about a silver bullet.
Yeah.
And Teresa knows immediately that it's now come to this.
Yeah, she says, doesn't she? This is all, it's, you know, me and Mike can speak about this podcast, guys, but it's intercut quite a lot, and it's very quick-paced. It's very well done, very well written, very well executed, shall we say. No pun intended there.
Yeah.
But it's very well done, it's very quick, it's all intercut, and there's just a lot going on at once, basically.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you touch on it there about the pacing of it.
Yeah.
We have this very kind of like slow build through, let's call it the three act, through the first act. It's very slow build up until we get to that rape scene.
Yeah.
And then it's quick. It happens. Yeah. The deed is done. She then kills the Marquez, and it's all very quick until she gets found. And then it slows down again.
And then it picks back up again.
Yeah. He starts to show the signs. Yeah. It picks up, and then boom, it slows down again. So it's almost like it's a fever pitch. Like, think of it as a heartbeat going.
Yeah.
And as the events are picking up, the heartbeat's racing and the fever's kicking in.
Yeah.
And I think, like you say about the pacing, I'm getting more and more kind of like with
on edge,
with No, I'm very much getting closer to your opinion of this film.
Oh yeah.
The more we talk about it, the more we break it down and how it feels going through it. But it is primarily how it's received. It may not have been the original intent.
Well, we both know the final film, you know, they got upon release was vastly different to the one me and you know.
Yeah.
I would love to see it in its original cut, just to see how fucking bad it is, basically, and how much we actually missed out and didn't get to see, just to compare the two of them.
Yeah.
But this, of course, leads into the big climactic finish, and we finally see the werewolf. see the werewolf. I say that like I'm like having a go, but I'm not.
It's been building to
this point. Yeah, it's been building and building and building, and the payoff is now, and it's fucking worth it. It's so worth it.
And it also has my favourite shot of the film. It's when Lion is sitting on the edge of the bed, his face is partially lit, and it's just looking at him.
Yeah.
And everything else is dark, and when his cellmate says, oh, it's a full moon.
And from there, it goes from 0 to 100 very, very quickly. The guy throws his drink out and startled and everything.
Yeah.
And it's when he turns his back, and you just get that shot of him over his shoulder, and the guy's looking at him, and they're going back and forth, and then it cuts back, and you get that reveal, and his face has changed. You're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is it. Again, this is, you know, me and Mike speaking about it. This is intercut between the werewolf attack and Alfredo going to get the bullet.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a lot of back and forth, but the werewolf attack, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. And the first time you properly see him as well, and it's a hell of a payoff.
And he's tearing out his clothes as well.
Oh, it's just, what a scene.
It is brilliant. And you see the brute strength of what he can do when he rips that door.
Oh, 100%. Like, the guy can, the police officer, you know, whatever the hell he was overwatching him. He's obviously killed the guy in the cell with him. He comes in at the aftermath when he's, like, literally ripping him to shreds. Blood everywhere coming down his mouth and everything. And he just goes over and just takes the door off. Like, it's not any problem in the world.
Yeah.
And then just fucking throws a door at him. Like, if that's not going to work, it'll kill someone. I don't know what will. But yeah, this is the big reveal. The lighting is fantastic in it. The shots in it are fantastic. The makeup is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's from my understanding, the actress who played Christina apparently couldn't even eat lunch with Oliver Reed when he was in full makeup.
Yeah.
Because it freaked her out that much. So he obviously gets out of jail, kills the two of them. All while Alfredo's gone and he's getting his bullet. And this is when it comes into the scene you were describing a couple of minutes ago, when Teresa turns around to Christina and she's like, oh, yeah, the bullet's the only thing that'll kill a werewolf. And it's a realisation Christina has then. She's like, oh, shit.
Yeah. this like, is real.
Yeah, this is real. This is actually happening. They go out into the town where at this point a mob is gathered at the prison.
Yeah.
Where he's escaped from. It's the aftermath. And it's essentially gone into mob mentality. They're all there with their fucking torches and pitchforks at this point. Trying to kill him. And he's spotted on the roof. Chase ensues. I'm only, like, glossing over this scene slightly, but, like, the stunt, he climbs a full fucking set.
I saw this was fantastic. And I thought, what the hell?
Yeah. It's brilliant to watch, though.
He starts from the boat, and then he, like, goes up he climbed the entire thing.
From what I watched behind the scenes, like, they did have a stunt double, because Oliver Reed wasn't even crazy enough to do that. But, like, the bits on top of the clock tower at the end, where he's overlooking, he's, like, out on the edge and all that, that was all Oliver Reed.
Yeah.
But obviously the climbing wasn't. I can't blame the guy, I gotta be honest.
I was looking at her and I was saying, what if, like, he slipped?
Apparently, the stunt double said the only difference between the two of them, from, like, long shots now, because obviously they didn't, the closest and that they would have had Reed for, he said the only difference was the contacts, which Reed, in all fairness, did stop wearing in the end, because they fucked his eyes up so badly. He said the eyes and the height. There was, like, literally a couple of inches height difference on him. Like, I didn't pick that up in the film.
Yeah, no, I didn't pick it up.
Like, 100%. But they basically corner him. There's this wonderful bit. I'm getting, you know, a little bit ahead of myself now. There's this wonderful bit where Christina runs into the town not really knowing what's going on, wants to try and find Leon, and he's up above her.
Yeah.
And you get that...
Oh, yeah, I love that shot.
You got that brief moment like, fuck, he's going to jump on her. He's going to kill her, yeah? And then the mob comes in.
Yeah.
And basically saves her. She's none the wiser, bless.
Yeah, no, she didn't know what was going on. Completely oblivious. Yeah.
Obviously finds out what's happening afterwards. And it's, for me, it's quite heartbreaking because you see him being chased and cornered by this mob. Teresa, Alfred and Christina all in that crowd basically watching on, knowing they cannot do shit because they'll be killed along with him, basically.
Yeah. It made me think of a scene that always kind of like gives me a little knot in my stomach from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah. Which scene? Go on.
The one where... I think her name's Christine. Christine is taken to be hung.
The blonde woman. Fuck,
and you have, like, Henry, his friend and stuff, watching, and then they just throw her off the top. And then the mum goes there, and she's trying to hold her feet up to stop her from choking. Her neck's broke, and they start throwing stones.
That was a horrible scene to watch.
But that's where it made me think of, when they're looking up, and then, of course, Alfredo goes into action.
Yeah, well, he knows he kind of needs to kill him for his own good. Because if the mob gets hold of him, he's
unconditional love will save him.
Yeah.
So, humanely.
Yeah, well, he basically loads up the bullet and he goes up, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Goes up to the bell tower. You know, this scene for me, this whole climactic scene, you see the production value.
Oh, yeah.
Massively. Like, it's quite nice to see because obviously Hammer are more well-known for doing a lower production...
Well, keeping that's tighter.
Yeah, something that's tighter, that's what I was trying to say. So to see quite a spectacle, much like we did in The Mummy with all the extras and, you know, some of the bigger scenes, it was quite a theatrical spectacle to watch. So it was quite nice seeing in this. But yeah, it's tragic at the end. Yeah. It's horrible to watch because he basically goes up, he knows, as you said, the unconditional love he has to give, he has to kill him.
Yeah.
You go up to the clock tower and, you know, he's struggling to get in his clock tower, the werewolf at this point.
Yeah.
And then you have that fucking iconic shot of him in the clock tower that has appeared on, like, every publicity shot for the film since. And that's it.
Yeah.
Bang, Alfredo shoots him. It's a really cool behind-the-scenes thing in this. When he shoots him and the blood spits out.
Yeah.
They used the fucking bike pump.
Oh, fair.
Like, used an actual bike pump. They put it under his leotard up there, rigged it to go. Bang, when he went.
Which isn't fair.
I was like, I found out, I was like, that's mental.
That that spurt of blood was cut from the original 1960s.
Yeah, I know, that was...
It showed him shoot, and then he was on the ground.
Because, like, you've got to give props to Oliver Reed for this scene, because he gets shot and he basically does what a dog would do when he gets shot.
Yeah.
It doesn't just die. He, like, rolled over and, like, looked, and that was it. Then he was dead.
Yeah. And then we get to see his face.
Yeah, this was another fantastic shot. Which was cut. Fucking sensitive, man. I swear to God. What, BBSC? What were you playing at? Oh my god.
They didn't want to see.
I was a lot of
coming from his mouth.
Yeah, he can't eat people and not, you know, he's got to clean himself up afterwards. Yeah. How dare you? You can eat people, but, you know, use a serviette.
He may be a wolfman, but he needs etiquette.
But that's pretty much it. That's the end of the film. In a very typical Hammer fashion, it ends very abruptly.
Yeah.
And, very, very abruptly.
I suppose on a bittersweet moment. It's not overtly happy. We won, but we lost.
For me, this has been like the most depressing film we've watched to date in this podcast series.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
That scene, bad enough alone, he covers him over, obviously, with his robe afterwards, you see the tear come out of his eye.
Yeah, I really like that.
I love that, but the one thing I loved about this, like that final shot, you obviously got, you know, him as a werewolf, the final shot, the eye tear and everything, fantastic, but this was the most depressing because of the final shot of the film.
Yeah.
You basically have a 2-second shot of Teresa and Christina stood in the middle of this now abandoned town square.
Yeah.
And she's just hugging Christina. Teresa's just hugging Christina.
Yeah.
There's no nice way out of this or happy ending at all in any aspect of this story.
No, definitely. Everyone's lost.
Yeah.
In this. Yeah. Like I say about Hammer having like the endings of we won, but we lost.
Yeah.
Leon's no longer afflicted.
Yeah.
By lycanthropy, but it had to be done this way.
And weirdly, you didn't see him turn back to a man
I remembered him being there, and when he turned him over, he had his normal face. But again, I think I'm mixing things.
Yeah. So, overall thoughts on the film?
I enjoyed it.
Is it worth watching? For anyone who is listening and hasn't seen this...
Yeah, I don't see anything in this film that's, a thumbs down or a negative. I think everything generally pays off really well.
Yeah.
From the performances, the cinematography, to the music, even though it's not James Bernard, but to the music. And seeing Oliver Reed, you know, cut his teeth as a leading role.
Just best of the best.
That was fantastic.
Yeah. Can't really get better than that, can you?
Yeah. Peter Cushing.
that is an argument for another podcast, I think. But yeah, great film all in all. As I said before, probably one of my favorite werewolf films.
Yeah,
you know, it is a slow burn, it's a long build up.
Yeah,
but I feel the payoff is worth it.
Yeah.
And my only complaint with the film is I would have loved to have seen more scenes with Oliver Reed as the werewolf. Is my only complaint.
Yeah.
Or, you know, seeing a bit more of him as an adult, maybe downgrade the first and the second act a bit more and give the third act a bit more, whereas he's an adult.
See, I personally would have shortened the middle.
The one as a kid.
Yeah, I would have shortened that.
Out of the three acts, that's probably the weakest.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, just a fantastic film all in all.
Yeah.
So I think that concludes another episode, Mike.
Brings us to the end.
To the end of another episode. Thank you for listening, for those who have listened. Go and enjoy our other episodes of the podcast. There's four more previous to this. And this is our fifth episode.
Yeah, the next one will be the last.
Yeah, the next one will be the last, folks. The last in this series, shall we say. It's not going to be the last Hooked on Horror podcast.
Depends if it's popular.
Yeah. If we are popular and more than two people listen to this, we will be making more podcasts.
First of all, we're not popular. We're us. And
to be fair,
the two people, me and you.
Didn't you say in the episode 2, backed by unpopular demand?
Yeah. And I was the popular thing.
I was the unpopular one. But no, thank you for listening, folks. Head over and check us out on the socials and the website, hooked-on-horror.com. So tune in next time. Thank you. Take care. Anything to add, Mike?
Goodbye.
There you go.